Oh, Al, I've just phoned, but Alma, you weren't in, so Alma said she would give you a message. I just wanted to say that I have another opportunity of making a tape, so and there were a few things that I had left unfinished, so I'll put it on this piece of tape, and you can keep it and do what you want with it if it's any use to you. The papers and the book that I sent you, perhaps you can return by mail. Well, I think I left a few things out about Cornwallis, but when the place was reopened, I was determined not to fall out with Roman Catholics. This is the thing that had bugged me all my service life, you know. It always made me feel uncomfortable, fall out Roman Catholics. The only place it was not observed was in Ontario, when I was commander there, and old Father MacLeod, MacLean, he felt that it wouldn't hurt the Protestants at all to hear a few RC prayers, and so he didn't bother about falling them out. And so when we had no, we had Harry Plowman as a Protestant padre, and but they were very, very short and were unable to provide us with an RC padre. So I was told the captain that I didn't want to fall out Roman Catholics, and of course he backed me up right, left and center. I found out he was quite a churchman, old Pip, and so I got a hold of the senior RC officer, who was Mark Preston, a supply commissioned officer, and put it to him. And Mark politely but very, very firmly declined. He said, "I can't do it, sir." He said, "I can't do it. You'd have to have a priest to do it." I said, "Why not?" He said, "Because you're not falling out the Catholics." Well, he stuck to his guns, so I thought, well, damn it. I know one or two of the RC prayers, having listened to Father MacLean. So, with the approval of the captain, I said, well, damn it, I'll take the RC prayers. And so, sure enough, after Harry Plowman had done his stuff at divisions, I stepped forward and you know, there was no levity about it, Hal. It was done with all the proper things, and I genuflected, which was not my practice, but I did the best I could, and I don't think it was that bad. Well, at that time, Father Joe Welly was the command chaplain, and he and I had, when I was in Naden at New Entry Training, we clashed swords a bit over me having the RCs parade the color guard. I made the New Entry parade the color guard each morning, you know, preserve the old customs introduced by Jarvis. And he objected, but I said, "They've got rifles, they're armed." I said, I'm not going to fall them out. But and old Joe was a great stickler for things, and he and I, we often clashed. And so, sure enough, after about a week of this, the word must have got to him. I don't know how he found out. But he came storming down, and he corralled me in my garden one Saturday afternoon. And he really jumped aboard me with both feet. I'm afraid he caught me with my Anglican pants down, because, you know, he threw Henry VIII at me and assaulted me right, left, and center, and I did my best to defend myself. But I found that I didn't know too much about the RC service. You know, of course, it was still done in the Latin there. Had I got an English missal and having read it and studied it, I probably would have found it how closely allied the two services are and how ridiculously small is the gap between them. I'm glad that Pope John, bless his heart, saw the reasonableness of this, and since then it's been ecumenical services have been welcomed. Anyway, I Joe says, "Well, you don't use the doxology." I said, "I don't when I'm dealing with Roman Catholics, and besides, we don't on one or two occasions use it in the Anglican prayers, but he really floored me right, left and centre, and forced me to get a history of my own church, what I read up. But what I should have done was really have got hold of a missal. Anyway, he made me fall them out, which I didn't like. I still wasn't very keen about it. But one thing it did do, it wiped away our previous differences, and from that day to this, we formed a bond of friendship between he and my family that persists to this day. Joe is retired and down in Florida now, and we exchange letters every Christmas, and he flatters me much more than I deserve in his letters, but we formed a very great friendship, not only with Myrtle and I, but with the rest of our family. Wendy's very fond of them, and he's very good with the grandchildren when he meets them. Anyway, that was the story of Joe. But Cappie Musgrave was a great one for collecting deacons, priests, and one thing and another. And on any special occasion, he'd get the chaplain on his foot. And his opposite number, Father MacIsaac, who really was a great character. And on one occasion, he had the Bishop of Nova Scotia, both chaplains of the feet, Father MacIsaac and Ernie Foote, as well as the local RC and the local Protestant people in the local area. And I think I mentioned the Bishop of Nova Scotia as well. We also had the Bishop of Nova Scotia's son, who was a UNTD, was now a sub-lieutenant, and was quite fine for the chaplaincy. And he was working in Cornwallis. So he had quite a gathering over his house. And just before the do, Scruffy O'Brien phoned around to Graham, the pay bob, and myself, and all the other heads of departments who were attending, and said, "Here, put on a dickey, on a clerical dickey, and turn your dinner, your wing collar backwards, and put on a different coloured dickey, and wear a blazer." So we thought this might be fun. So I put on my blazer, a collar backwards, and I had a purple handkerchief, which I spread over in front of my jacket. And I went over. I was required to go over a bit early, and I went in with my wife and Ernie Fitt, whom I knew very, very well. We'd had quite a lot of associates in the past. He sailed with us in Ontario, and he was a convivial type, and his wife was there. We had never met. And when I came in, of course, Ernie instantly recognized that I was wearing a bishop's frontal, and went out by me and kissed my hand. His wife was fooled. She really thought I was a bishop. She was furious with Ernie afterwards for tricking her like that. But they came in, Graham the paper, he came up with a green one, and there were black ones and white ones and cream-coloured, yellow. And the last two to come, and this, of course, everybody took it in the greatest of fun. And the last two to come in was Scruffy and his wife. And what Scruffy had a black one on. And nobody took much fuss about this until eventually, he, of course, you know how he attracted a crowd, and they were all around Scruffy, and he turned up the top his dicky front, and it had lace on it. And then he pulled it out and held it up, and damn it if it wasn't his wife's panties, which I thought was a pretty good one. Another thing old Scruff pulled on me is one Christmas, I went out to, as usual, first thing in the morning, and went out to go into the basin, and I noticed a large square board stuck in the garden. I looked around it, and And there, painted on it, white sign painted on it black, was seaman-like manner, which, as you know, was one of my favorite phrases. But he'd spelled it C-E-Y-M-A-N-L-Y-K-E-M-A-N-O-R. And this, because this, of course, became quite a feature of Cornwallis. And the divisional courses, officers' divisional courses that we used to get frequently from all parts of the Navy, would come down, and after a pretty strict couple of weeks, in which they really had to work hard, old Scruff would chase them right, left, and center. And their favorite practice was to steal this damn thing. But they didn't know that we had a very, very close liaison with the RCMP, who used to come into the wardroom any time they were down our way. And we'd phone up Bridgetown, the Mounted Police Headquarters, a local office there, and say, they've done it again. And they were just, they knew the cars, and we'd tell them the number of the car. They'd stop them, and they'd really speak to them sternly. And we always got it back the next day. So during the time I was there, we managed to hang on to that all the time. But during the, when I was talking to you about the last time, I was telling you about my early days in HMS Dispatch and leading Seaman Gilby, who, you know, the low-power LTO, who was also our instructor for torpedo and for qualifying acting ST, and a man who was my mentor. I regarded him very greatly. He taught me so very, very much. And he was a good principled man, a good, sound Christian. And he was respected by everybody in the ship. He was the leading hand of his mess, and had a quiet dignity about him that commanded respect. And I told you about him. Well, he left China early. He'd been selected to qualify for warrant rank. He passed his HETs and left the ship and went to England. And before he left, we exchanged photographs. I was going through my album the other day, and I found his picture, which reminded me that I'd forgotten to tell you the sequel to the Sam Gilby story. And I gave him a picture of myself. And I found out that there is a copy of this in the lookout office, Tassie. So if you want to track it down, there's one in there. His right-hand man is Ken Martin, who was a photographer. And I don't know how they got hold of this thing, but there it is. Anyway, when we were in Quebec, we were required to, at the request of the Lieutenant Governor of Quebec, to pay a visit to the city. And, of course, after we visited Quebec, we went on up to Montreal. And Roger Bidwell, once again, decided to wear his flag in the ship, and so, which I was very happy for him to do, because then he bore the social burden much greater than an assisted, you know, I wouldn't have had to be quite so much social responsibility on my own. Anyway, we went on up to Montreal and had a very, very close liaison with Donnacona, the reserve division there. And the electrical officer there, whom I had known, was of course a civilian and was familiar with electrical people. And he came aboard the ship one day, and he said, I know very well an old friend of yours with whom I work very closely. I said, who's that? He said, Sam Gilby. Well, I damn near fell over. This must have been 20 years before, and I'd never even... I knew Sam had a lady friend in Canada, because he told me that he'd once been serving on the West Indies Squadron, and the ship had gone from Halifax up to Quebec, Quebec to Montreal, and he met this girl up there. So, and I found out that he was still in, that he was in Montreal. So we were having a cocktail party, and I immediately, from this electrical officer, got hold of Sam's address and issued him an invitation. And sure enough, standing at the gangway with the admiral, I looked along the the jetty, and there I saw Sam and his lady walking on, aged a bit, but still Sam Gilby. And I was very, very proud to introduce old Sam to Roger Bidwell. I said, "Sir, I'd like you to meet Leland Seanum Gilby, the killick of my mess." And so Sam and I got together, and we had a long, long chat. And apparently, he qualified as warrant officer, and after a short period, and this was at the time of the Geddes Acts, and it was so very easy to get out of the RN in those days, and they gave him the golden bowler, which turned out to be brass. And so he got out, and he went over to Montreal, and of course it was getting around the Depression time, and work was very, very hard to get hold of. And he managed to get hold, got a job as maintenance in the generator and battery rooms of the telephone company in Montreal. Well, this is one thing that Sam didn't know a great deal. Well, he was a very, very intelligent and clever man anyway. And he certainly knew his batteries, and he certainly knew his generators. And so he got a job there as watchkeeper in, 12 hours on and a few hours off, and in the generator and battery room of the Bell Telephone, the Montreal Telephone Organization, which I think was a sort of, they always had a battery backup. It was a low voltage system. And Sam, being a sailor, being around there, he looked around, and he wasn't going to sit on his backside all the time, and so he looked around and uncovered all the brass tallies, scraped them off, polished them up, and